Hello and welcome to episode 20 of the Talking Football Podcast. My name's Derek Clark, and each week I bring you an exclusive in-depth interview with some of the most colourful and interesting characters in the game. Don't worry if you've missed any so far. You can listen to them back on iTunes, Spotify, SoundCloud, Podbean, and also on derekclarksport.co.uk. This week I got the chance to speak to a former Canadian international, probably best known for his time in Scotland, playing for Inverness, Caledonian Thistle and Livingston. It was a real delight to chat to David Sousa, who's transitioned from a footballer to a successful businessman. He's got stories galore, and even tells us a terrific tale involving Jose Mourinho and the late great Sir Bobby Robson when he turned down Sporting Lisbon. It's another fascinating listen, and I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. So sit back and enjoy this week's episode of the Talking Football Podcast. Welcome everyone to another edition of the Talking Football Podcast. I'm delighted to say this week we're joined on the line by former Canadian international that will be known, I'm sure, with Inverness and Livingston supporters in particular, David Sousa. David, thanks very much for joining us.
Yeah, no, thank you very much for the opportunity.
Fantastic career in the game. We'll kick off all the way back when you were growing up in Canada, back at born in Vancouver, 1976, is that correct?
Yeah, 1976 seems like a million years ago.
Were you always kicking a ball around as a young boy?
Yeah, I mean, my parents were both Italian immigrants to Canada, so I'm, you know, first generation Canadian. And yeah, I mean, obviously in Canada, especially back then, soccer wasn't really still isn't today, the sport of choice. You know, everybody's pretty hockey crazy. You know, having grown up with Italian parents and through the Italian community, it was pretty much all I knew.
And did you have any sort of role models growing up? Any players that you looked up to? You had posters on your wall at all?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we used to, my dad, you know, he used to go back every year. We used to go back to Italy for about 10 years and we would stay in his little village. And I was a diehard Juventus fan. So I remember back in the day, you know, the favorite players I had and had all the Juve posters on my wall. So, yeah, I mean, I think historically for me, the guys I looked to was, you know, sort of the 82 Italian national team when they won the World Cup. That was kind of my big team that I looked up to.
Yeah. Did you manage to get yourself along to any Juventus games at all?
You know, the last Juventus game I went to was actually Celtic against Juventus, which was probably one of the most incredible games I've ever seen, I think.
Was that the 4-3 game?
Yeah, it was a 4-3 game at Juventus, and I brought my brother-in-law at the time. And, you know, what a game. That was his first match ever that he saw. And then he came to a Livingston game and went, hold on a second. it was quite a night. So that was really the last Juventus game I've been to. But I have two sons. One is 10 and one is 7, and they're both soccer crazy. So I'm sure we'll make our way over soon enough.
Yeah, excellent stuff. When you were growing up, you'd have been, I guess, 8 years old when Canada were in the World Cup. Can you remember sort of watching them on the TV?
Yeah, for sure. 86 was, you know, pretty crazy year. I mean, I was 10 years old. I look at my son now and how, you know, how much he knows about the game. Obviously, a different time now in terms of, you know, the profile of players and social media and that sort of thing. But yeah, I absolutely remember, and you know, it was funny. A lot of the players that were on that team were influential on my career. You know, someone like a Bobby Lanarduzzi, who was my Olympic team coach, was, I think, the Canadian. I don't know if he was the captain, but he, you know, he played in that tournament. I can't remember. You know, there's several guys that yeah. were sort of there or thereabouts when I was growing up, and it was great to have, you know, some role models really that you could look to.
And I mean, was there a period? Was there a point in time when you were growing up and you realised that you were pretty good at soccer and you could sort of carve a career in the game?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question, right? I mean, I think growing up, I don't think you ever look in the mirror and go, you know, I'm this and that. But you know, I think the game came pretty naturally to me. You know, I think for me, it was always something that I wanted to do. You know, my dad was a bricklayer. So very, very blue collar job, very, you know, very kind man, but a very hard man. So, you know, the alternative was for me, either I'm going to make it as a professional soccer player at the time in my mind, or I was going to be building brick walls. So my motivation was pretty easy to try to figure out a way to make it. So, I mean, I think the first real time for me was, you know, you know, I started training with, you know, the U20 and Olympic teams when I was like 14 or 15 years old. So, you know, for me, I was always able to play up, which was great. And I was always able to kind of be tested in that sense. Had a couple great, you know, mentors, one specifically Bruce Twombly, who played in England, played for Bobby Robson, I think at Ipswich. And he really was super influential on my career, probably when I was 13, 14 years old. So, So I think that was probably when I said, hey, maybe I've got a chance at this. And again, for me, it was always one eye on playing professional and one eye not building brick walls. You know, not that that's not a great profession. my dad has done very, very well and lives a very comfortable life because of it. But for me, at least at that time, it was just not what I wanted to do.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned there, Twombly and Bobby Robson. Is it right you got a trial over at Sporting Lisbon when Bobby was over there?
Yeah, this is actually, I made some notes on this last night because it's quite an amazing story. Not the Dave Zales part, but the whole story part. So I was about 15 years old, 14 or 15 years old, and I got a call in the summer from Bruce, and he said, Dave, I have an opportunity for you to go to Portugal. And first thing I did was, you know, open the Atlas and go, okay, hold on, where exactly am I going? And and he kind of spoke to me about it and said, I have an opportunity for you to train with the youth team there for 3 months. You'd live in the stadium. So I lived in the Jose Alvalade Stadium.
Wow.
And Bobby's there, you know, and I was like, who's Bobby? And so anyways, did my research, the best part of this story is, I mean, obviously I'll kind of get into a little bit of what happened, but I remember, 15-year-old kid coming from Canada where people don't even know we play soccer, landing in Lisbon. And, you know, they'd given me some directions on where to go. And I get to the bus stop and, you know, outside of the airport. And they're like, there's this guy that's going to meet you. He's our translator. You know, he speaks English perfectly, so he'll help you out. So I'm standing there with my suitcases, and this gentleman walks up, very handsome man, and says, David, you know, welcome. I'm Jose. I'm Bobby's translator.
Wow.
I'm very excited to have you, da, 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 da. And so we all know who the Jose was.
Yeah.
It was Mr. Mourinho. And, you know, at that time, he was a translator, right? I mean, at that time,
yep.
He was a wonderful guy, and he was always watching and always studying. But he was Bobby's right-hand man, and it was amazing. I mean, I look back now, and I tell the story, and people look at me and go, yeah, sure that happened. And I'm like, no, it happened. So I spent 3 months there. I spent 3 months, I don't know, I think I did fairly well when I first went, and within a month, I was training with the first team. And I was traveling with the first team a little bit, and I was like 16 years old at the time, and I was traveling with the first team to tournaments and, you know, just their kind of summer preseason. And I remember looking back now, and in the locker next to me was on one side was like George Cadete, and on the other side was Luis Figo.
Wow.
And I look back now and go that the players that they produced at that time, you know, you go through that locker room, I know Krasimir Balakov hasn't had a good time recently in the media and stuff, and for the whole Bulgaria situation. But he was probably the best player I've ever seen. And so he was in the team. Stan Valks was a Dutch international. So I honestly, it was so weird. I kind of became part of the team, and you know, obviously on the outskirts of it. And I remember, you know, Bobby kind of saw me one day and kind of said, "What are you doing here?" And I said, "I don't know. They told me to." The first team. You know, and for me, I thought, oh, it's because I know him. But when he saw me and said, "No, like, I didn't realize you were even going to be here," kind of thing. So it was pretty cool. I mean, Bobby and I became pretty close when I was there. Obviously, he didn't speak a ton of the language. You know, I watched his documentary recently, and he was an amazing man, but he's never good at languages.
No.
And so we spent a lot of time together. I actually stayed with him for a little bit in his flat. He'd go golfing, and I'd caddy for him. Like, it was amazing. It was an amazing time, right? I tell the stories, and people just, they just don't believe it. So after, I guess it was 3 or 4 months, they sat me down, and you know, I was kind of torn at the time. I was 16. You know, I liked being there, obviously, but I was a young kid away from home. I always said if I wasn't going to play pro, I was going to go to university. I want to go to a good school and get a good degree and really, you know, build a business or do something in the future. So they offered me a 3-year deal, and it was a youth team deal or whatever, and I decided to come home. So, you know, you can imagine how devastated most people were with my decision. You know, I think people thought it was a huge missed opportunity, and maybe it was, you know, maybe it was, but I don't look back with any regrets. It was honestly 3 of the best months that I've ever had in my life. And, you know, it's funny, I look back and, We used to live in a room of four. So I had a Brazilian guy, I had two Portuguese guys, and then I had, I think the other guy was from Angola. His name was Nello, was his name. Mm-hmm. But the other two guys were two guys that English football fans will probably be familiar with. One was a guy named Danny, who played for West
yes.
Ham. And I think he played at...
was it Ajax, I think? He went to Ajax, I'm sure.
He played at Ajax as well. One of fantastic finisher. We used to play up front together for those three months. Much better finisher than I was, that was for sure. And the other guy was Beto. And Beto became Sporting Lisbon captain. And I think he played for Portugal 20 or 30 or 40 times. So anyways, just a really, pretty cool experience for me. And I kept some stuff. We had won a youth team tournament, a couple tournaments. So I kept the sashes and, the first team had signed a banner for me, so I've got all their names on it. And yeah, it was pretty surreal, right? And
yeah,
I would say probably the most surreal thing of the whole thing is, and this I think shows the kind of person that Bobby was. Bobby wrote me a letter when I left.
Wow.
And my mom is amazing. She would laminate everything so it would stay true. And Bobby basically wrote me a 2-page letter back in front saying what a pleasure it was to get to know me, and I think you're making a big mistake. So I only read the front half of that letter most days because I don't want to read the back where he says you're making a mistake. So anyways, and the really cool thing is Bobby, I don't know if people know this, he used to come to Canada in the summer once in a while with his wife, and they would stay with Bobby or with Bruce Twombly has a house on Vancouver Island. And Bobby would call me up Bruce would call me up and say, Bobby's coming for next week, do you want to come over and come for lunch or come for a round of golf? So I'd see him, a couple times over the 10 years or whatever, in Canada, which was nuts, right? So no, just a great, I know he's got such a great following and such a great reputation, but seeing it firsthand and the kindness of the man to a young Canadian kid that really he had no reason to be so kind to, it was pretty amazing.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned the documentary. I watched it a couple of weeks ago myself. It was a fascinating watch, and he certainly comes across as a warm and kind, definitely a dedicated football man, but funny as well.
Yeah, he was. I mean, he was, the players all thought he was nuts, right? I mean, he was he was on the borderline of eccentric being, borderline.
Yeah.
And Jose's just trying to keep up, right? Bobby's all hands and his words and he's using the fists and it was just, it was hilarity, right? It was just, I feel so privileged to have been part of that. It was just for a young Canadian kid, what a story to tell. And I remember, hopefully some of my high school friends will listen to this, but I wore my Sporting Lisbon sweaters to school every day
for like 300
quite right. days in a row. Oh yeah. It was a pretty proud moment. The other cool thing about living in the stadium was at the time, this is non-soccer related, but hopefully people will get a kick out of this, is the concerts used to come through there all the time.
Mm.
So we would be living in the stadium, weekdays, weekends, the Portuguese players would go home, but I would stay with the Brazilian guys and, the guys from Angola or whatever. And we'd watch these concerts that were there, but where we stayed, like our digs in the stadium were right next to where all the acts would prepare. So I met Prince. I met
wow.
Jovi. I met, I think Madonna came through there.
No way.
And we, we'd get into the concerts and it was just a crazy time. It was just, for me, it was just, hey, this must be normal. I think this is what everybody's doing. So anyways, it was a pretty crazy time, but very, very memorable, obviously.
Yeah, I've been to a game there. I went to a game there in 2004 when the Euros were there, but I can't imagine you staying in the stadium. Talk us through that. How was there sort of like apartments within the ground?
Yeah, you can call them apartments. They're definitely one of that. But, they were basically what it was. It was like a youth hostel. So on one floor of the building, they had about, I'd say about 10 rooms.
Yeah.
10 rooms with four beds and sort of, you had your own little desk and there was like common bathrooms. And we would live there and we would basically, train twice a day or whatever it was, live in the stadium. We had all our cleaning done. They had food there in the stadium for us. We'd eat in the restaurant and, on the weekends, I remember this pretty funny. I think I must've been 16 because I say 15, but I think I was 16 because I had my driver's license.
Mm-hmm.
And I was one of the only youth guys that had my driver's license. And I remember Stan Volks, he used to always ask me, cause he spoke English as well. What are you doing this week? And I said, oh, you know, you're looking at it, right? I live in a stadium. So he said, why don't you take my club car? And I thought, well, you know, Stan, I don't know if that's such a good idea. He said, no, you take my club car. So all of a sudden I was the most popular guy in the stadium. And, we would take the car and go down to Qashqai's and down to Algarve for a drive, or go to the beach for the day, or we'd go, you know, visit, you know, one of the guy's girlfriends or whatever. It was a ton of fun. And all the one thing I remember is that the players were genuinely very happy. You know, they were very positive, and they were just enjoying themselves, you know. And I don't know if it was Bobby. I don't know if it was the fact that I think at the time they were the best team in Portugal. You know, Portuguese U-20s had just won the U-20 World Cup. And I think there was like 8 of them or something, or 7 of them on the team, you know, Pesh, Pofidio, like they just had like the players were just, you know, off the charts. Right. So anyways, yeah. Little side story that I thought is kind of funny for listeners for sure.
Yeah, it definitely is that. So you went to university then to study finance, and the football career, did you sort of put that on hold for a period of time, or were you still looking for it to carve a career in the game?
Yeah, no, I think what was really cool about, you know, the U.S. at that time is Clive Charles, which, again, I think a lot of people will know that name. He played for, I think, for West Ham or Southend for a lot of times. He was, I think, one of the first black professional players in England. And so he was the head coach of the University of Portland. So I went to, you can imagine, you know, playing soccer in Canada, pretty highly recruited. I went to Stanford, Notre Dame, all these schools on recruiting trips, but I always wanted to play soccer afterwards. And so I went to the best soccer school I could find, which was the University of Portland. They had a 4,000-seater stadium. Casey Keller went there.
Was
a goalkeeper there for – not when I was there, but before. So they had some success really bringing players to England and to Europe. So I went there and said, you know, Clive, I want to get a degree, and I need you to make me a professional when I'm done. So anyways, I played for 3 years there. Was fortunate enough to – we have something called the Final Four, which is kind of like I would equate it to the championship playoffs, right? So you think there's 100 teams, 200 teams. You basically are getting down to one. So twice we made the Final Four, or once we made the Final Four and lost in the semifinal. And anyways, had a pretty good experience there. And then in 96, we had Olympic – 95, 96 was qualifying for the Olympics. And I was chosen to be part of the Canadian Olympic team. I was only 18 or 19 at the time, and it was U23. So pretty good achievement for me at that time. And I think I was the number 10. Anyways, we went through qualifying, and we ended up finishing second to Mexico, I think. Second to Mexico. U.S. already qualified because obviously it was in Atlanta. So Mexico qualified, and we had to play the winner of Oceania. And the winner of Oceania is obviously always Australia.
Yeah.
So to get to the 96 Olympics, probably this is the, you know, I said I don't have any regrets, but I'd say this is the number one regret in my life is we were 45 minutes away from going to the Olympics in Atlanta in 96. And so we played, Australia came to us, and this team, you could imagine this team at the time was, you know, Mark Maduka, Harry Kewell.
Some players there.
Scott. Oh man, like the golden generation of the Australian, team. And unfortunately, it was at the same time that we almost qualified for the Olympics. So we played in Canada. We played in Edmonton in front of 50 or 60,000, which was, you know, just a whole different experience for us. And we tied 2-2, and I scored both goals that game. And, you know, that got me a little bit of profile, especially in Australia. They were like, who is this guy that's screwing up our whole thing? And, you know, the team, we didn't play well on the day. But we drew 2-2. We went to Australia, and you know, it's crazy, right? You got 23 young guys getting on a plane flying to Australia, and we flew to Sydney, and we stayed in a place called Manly Beach, which was probably the worst mistake. Which now I look back and now I get why they put us on the beach, because we weren't thinking about the game very much. And we ended up playing. We ended up playing in the main stadium there in Sydney in front of 30 or 40,000. I can't remember. And it was 1-0 at halftime, I think. And we ended up losing 5-0. But at that point, it really didn't matter, right? It was, you know, Jason DeVos making runs like he was a center forward.
Oh, dearie me.
Which he should never do.
No.
And anyways, we ended up losing 5-0. And again, probably one of the biggest regrets of my life. We were so close to what I had sort of as one of my lifetime goals. And, you know, we never got back again because at that time it was U23. And I missed the next Olympic qualifying. But yeah, I mean, good. It was a good, great experience, great bonding of the lads. And, you know, it was, anyways, that was kind of my, where I got kickstarted. I ended up getting a couple calls from a couple agents. I had seen the games, thought I had played really well. I said, hey, I think you might have a future here. And I decided to leave school. I had one semester, I had one semester left of my finance degree. So now I'm thinking, oh God, I came here to get my degree. I'm leaving before I have my degree. Like, this isn't the plan. And so I said, kind of screw it. And on December 21st, I think, I boarded a plane and I took a plane over to Port Vale and or over to the UK. And I ended up with John Rudge at Port Vale. And that's where I started my this kind of journey into trying to be a professional.
And of course, that you had a trial there. I was reading it. It wasn't quite successful, but you joined a sort of local rivals, if you like, Stoke City.
Yeah. This is another one of those things where I think nobody knows the real true story. So it kind of looks like a blemish on my career, but there's a hell of a lot of backstory to that. So I was at Port Vale, and I had, you know, I thought I had really done very well when I was there. And at the time, I think Gareth Ainsworth was in the team, who's now I see managing very successfully down.
Yeah, the longest serving manager now in the UK.
Oh, wonderful guy, lovely guy. Again, to me, you know, Canadian kid that was trying to get a job, and I remember the guys were pretty good at that time, and I thought I had done really well. And again, probably hurt me more than sitting down with Bobby Robson, you know, writing me that letter, was when John Rudge said, "Listen, we're not going to give you a contract. I just don't have, you know, the ability right now." And it was just devastating. It was devastating. And so I went back to where I was billeting, you know, in some people's basement, which was, again, super creepy. And, you know, Christmas Day, they gave me, I think one of my most vivid memories is I hate orange and chocolate together. And they gave me an orange chocolate for Christmas that year. And I thought, oh, this can't get any worse. Anyways, maybe it did. So I ended up getting a call from the agent, said, hey, listen, I guess someone had seen me play. I'd played at Stadium of Light against Sunderland in some games, and I'd played here and there, you know, in reserve games. And they said, Stoke wants to sit down. They want to talk. And I said, great. You know, it's a short drive, which is good. And the manager was Chris Kamara at the time. I'm a Canadian kid that had no idea, you know, where Stoke on Trent is. And I'm sitting down with Chris Kamara, and the most, vivid, you know, very, you know, eccentric, manager. And you're, you know, if you look at a picture of him and Clive Charles, they pretty much look exactly the same. So I felt like, oh, this is awesome. This is like my second father kind of thing. So anyways, I trained. I think I did very, you know, I think I did well at training. At that time, one of the players I remember, there was an Irish international there, Graham Cavanaugh, was a fantastic player. I just remember him from training and things like that. Anyways, I get a call, and I think they had just signed Kyle Lightbourne at the same time. So they signed a couple strikers. And they threw me into my first match against Bury. And that was the first and the last match I played. And I was on the bench for the second match at home at Stoke. And then I think Chris got fired or got sacked. And I was on a pretty short-term deal. I think it was like a year or something like that. And as they do in management, right, your face doesn't fit and out you go.
So, yeah.
So they, you know, you can again imagine, right? There's a Canadian kid that doesn't really know his head from a hole in the wall. And now they're like, okay, there's a team in Scotland. And I'm like, okay, back to the Atlas. And there's a team up there that's going to take you and Jerry McMahon. And they want to sign you guys to a couple of year deals. And da-da-da-da. So great. This is easy. This is easy. Another team wants to sign me. Let's go. So get on a plane, fly up to I think we flew into Glasgow and Edinburgh. And signed a deal with Paul Sturrock at St. Johnston, and it was probably the worst 2 years of my life, to be completely honest.
Wow.
I loved, you know, Jerry was awesome, probably one of my favorite people, and his wife Adele were so kind to me when I was living there. And there was another Canadian there, Nick Dazovich, at the time, who obviously still friends with. But it was a very it was an awakening to the world of Scottish football, in the sense that I came from a, you know, big fish in a small pond in Canada, for sure. You know, probably one of the top prospects, you know, coming out of the country. Had success at an international level with the U-20s and the U-23s. Go over to England. Don't have a horrible time, but, you know, it didn't really work the way I would have wanted. Ended up in Scotland with Paul Sturrock, who, you know, a lot of people will say he's some of their favorite managers. And for me, it wasn't the case. You know, I just didn't, I didn't develop, you know, whether it was I was too soft, whether it was I took things too personally. I think it definitely takes some time to understand Scottish banter, which I love now. You know, obviously I loved even hearing your voice calling me this morning. It's always good to hear the twang. But it was a really hard 2 years for me because I didn't play at all really in the first team. I played a lot of resi. There was no development for me. Like, it was more a dog eat dog world, and maybe it wasn't their job to develop me. Right. I mean, they had bought a professional player, and here I was probably needed a lot of coaching. And yeah, I just never really got in my rhythm. You know, if I would have known what I know now, I would have got on loan, you know, really quickly, but nobody ever talked to me about loans or, because I think that would have helped, you know, just playing games. And so it didn't go well. It was a pretty brutal 2 years, I'll be honest. I didn't enjoy St. Johnson. I didn't enjoy the club. You know, they were very nice to me and everything, but I just didn't enjoy my experience. And I really started to second guess if this was for me and if I really wanted to keep going.
It's funny you mentioned Nick Dazovic. We had him on actually a couple of weeks ago, and he was talking about his time. He says he thoroughly enjoyed it. Did he sort of try and help you settle in a bit, because he was obviously from Vancouver like yourself?
Yeah, for sure he did. I mean, I think Nick's in my trajectory in terms of St. Johnson were very, very different. I think he's a club legend. He's an icon there. You know, he was older. He was married. You know, I think he had a little more – he had some good mates on the team. So I think, and he had good success. He was playing well, and he was starting, and he was playing. And I think, as any footballer will tell you, if you're not playing, you're not happy. So for me especially, it wasn't even that I was on the borders of making the squad. Like, I just felt like I was never even close. And so it was just so demoralizing every day. And Nicky's he's a wonderful guy, and he's a wonderful player, and he had a great career. So again, his view of his experience would be very different than mine.
Yeah.
And again, I don't take it personal. I'm sure I could have changed things or made different decisions at the time or whatever, but it is what it is. And for me, it was just not a good time of my life.
Yeah. So you went to Holland for a spell as well. What how did that move all come about?
Yeah, I'm trying to think back, and I think it was someone that I had been working with, or a friend had mentioned, I think your style might be more suited to this. And so I got an opportunity to go to a team that was, you know, building. They were trying to qualify for the Eredivisie playoffs, and anyway, signed a 2-year deal there, I think, at the time, a year and a half, 2-year deal. And, you know, polar opposites, right? Like, fresh start, you know, they spoke a little bit of English, so it was fairly easy, you know, versus a Portugal, which was a little more difficult. But it was just more of a, I always say this, you know, and I know people joke about it, but it really was more of a football education. You know, I'd walk into the locker room before a match, and on the wall there was like 22 full scat pieces of paper outlining everywhere that I should be in every situation of the game.
Wow.
Whether it was set pieces, whether it was in full play, whether it was in defensive, it was really a football education. You know, it was me learning, you know, instead of, you know, being the best player and being able to do what I wanted and not really be the part of the team, right? And people would try to just get me the ball or whatever. Now you're part of a unit. You have a job. You have responsibilities. And, you know, as great as Scotland was at that time when I was there, and again, it was a tough time for me personally, but, you know, St. Johnson had success. There was none of that, you know. We were still eating Aggies, you know, whatever she was making. We don't even know what kind of meat it was. But, you know, there was no nutrition. There was no, they did a pretty good job of, you know, fitness, and they were starting to get into this sort of fitness craze a little bit in terms of taking better care of your bodies. But it was nothing like Holland, right? It was just such a different experience, and I loved it. And I almost felt like I was a kid again, and I had an opportunity to soak up as much of this as I can, with the goal, obviously, of trying to go back to the UK. And I did. So I spent a year and a half there, and much different than what I would say in my time in Scotland. That was probably the best year and a half that I had. I loved Holland. We loved traveling in and around where I lived, just outside of Rotterdam. You know, I had fairly good success playing. I had played quite a bit. The team was winning. We qualified for the playoffs. And and it was great. I had a really thoroughly enjoyable time. And then I decided to leave and go back to the UK because I really felt that's, you know, I felt like I was ready again. You know, I think that's probably what it was. I think I probably went unprepared. And then when I came back, I was confident. You know, I think this is the big thing, right, with football, and I'm sure everybody will say this, but more so with me. And I read a great quote. One of my favorite players of all time that I played with is Barry Wilson.
Ah, yes.
And Barry was a great lad, and he was really pretty supportive of me. You know, not outwardly, but I knew he was. And he had a perfect quote of me the other day, and he said I was like Marmite. He says, you know, you either love him or you hate him. And I think he loved me. I hope he did, anyways. But I just got to this point where I didn't care. You know, I was gonna play the way I wanted to play. I was gonna be confident. And so we went back to the UK, and luckily for me, I went back to somewhere that, you know, you're not under a huge microscope in Inverness, but it was enough of a exposure that I thought, hey, I can get another shot here. And again, I met probably one of the nicest men, one of the best man managers that I've ever met, in Steve Patterson. And he really helped me blossom as a player. He gave me the confidence. He was a wonderful guy to play for. The club was, you know, super supportive. It's always nice to feel wanted and welcome, and I always felt wanted and welcome there. If anything, the way I left, I wish I could have, you know, not had to leave. You know, I wish we were in the Premier League. I often look back and say, you know, I really enjoyed my time there, and we had a great team and a great squad and a good group of guys. And Steve was a great manager, and, you know, I know he's had his troubles, and I read his book, and I read it with a lot of warmth and support for him, because I know he had a lot more in him too. So anyways, so that was my transition from Holland back to Scotland.
Yeah. And I mean, you were staying up in the Highlands as well. So how did you find living up there?
Yeah, it was weird. Like, I never really thought otherwise. Right. It was, you know, I know some of the guys, I mean, there were some guys that drove from Glasgow every day.
No way. Wow.
You guys are nuts.
No way.
They carpool and, you know, it would never work. Right. So I lived there and I loved it. I had a nice little flat overlooking the Firth of Forth.
Yes, I know we are, yeah.
Like the bridge, and wake up in the morning, drive my club car down to the club. All the guys were good. We'd have good training sessions. You know, Steve was a player's manager. We played attacking football. I think he liked me as a player. Obviously, I played all the time. And he was very supportive. He used to say, you're too good for this division. You know, you're going to get out of this division. You just got to keep working. And you know, the world is your oyster at that point, right? The world is your oyster. And
yeah.
And I just loved playing for him. I loved playing for the club. I loved scoring goals. And again, we had Barry, and we had, you know, Mark McCullough. We had, you know, Dennis Wyness later, who, again, was probably one of the greatest scorers in the history of the club. And we just had a great group. Paul Sheeran, like, you talk about having a good squad and a good team in the first division. That team should have been playing in the Premier League. So,
yeah.
So anyways, that was that. And I had a good, great run there. And at that time, my contract was coming up, I think, at the end of the season. I can't remember, my second season. And I had been to meet Bobby Williamson from Kilmarnock. I had a couple clubs from England poking around. I'd had actually a team from Korea that was interested, Samsung Blue Wings at the time, because obviously I was playing internationals. And I played South Korea a couple times. Aberdeen was sniffing around, but they wanted me to go on trial. And I said, like, I'm an hour and a half away. Why don't you come watch the game? Like, I'm just down the road. So maybe that was a bit arrogant at the time. I probably should have gone and trialed or whatever. But anyways, and the club had said, listen, we want you to stay. We want you to stay long term. And my partner at the time she wanted to, you know, pursue her career as well. And it just was more opportunities down in Edinburgh and Glasgow. So Livingston, I think I'd scored a hat trick against Livingston for Inverness like 2 or 3 weeks before they bought me. And I know they were buying everybody. Anybody that had a good game against them at the time, you know, Alex Burns and Marvin Andrews and everyone was Dave Fernandez, we're all getting bought up by Livingston, right? So I just thought it was a great story. I thought it was a cool, it was a really, really cool opportunity. You know, again, they wanted me, which was the main thing. I met with Leishman, and, you know, if you can't meet with Jim Leishman and not feel like, you know, you got to go with him, then you might have a screw loose, because he's just got that kind of infectious personality. And that's what I did. So we went down to Perth. You know, the irony of it, right? I'm sitting in the hotel of the place, which was probably the worst 2 years of my footballing career. You know, I lived in this hotel for 6 months, and I'm signing my contract in the lobby. So it was a bit of an FU to Perth. And, you know, and anyways, it all kind of came around, and that kind of started the transition over to Livingston.
Yeah, but before we go, move on to Livingston, David, you didn't play in the famous game where they beat Celtic 3-1, but what was that like to be around the club when that result happened? Because it sent sort of shockwaves across the world.
Yeah, and that's kind of what I was saying is, you know, that squad that we had was a good squad. And, you know, I'm not saying that I was always in the first 11, but, you know, to lose a first 11 player and still go there and do what they did, I think everybody else was shocked except for me. You know, I knew the boys were playing well and I knew we could go anywhere and get a result. I think I was lying on the beach in Bermuda when we were playing. So I think Canada was playing Bermuda in some sort of a qualifier. So I remember this like nobody's business. I was sitting around the pool. You know, I probably shouldn't say this out loud, but I was sitting around the pool while the boys were playing against Celtic in the rain. And and I remember my national team manager said, you guys just beat Celtic. And I think it was 3-1, right? 3-1?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah.
Celtic 3-1 at Celtic Park. And I said, come on, you got to be pulling my leg. He's like, no, you guys beat Celtic. So, yeah, it was just a very proud moment for me, proud moment for the club. I think it was a real, you know, David and Goliath kind of situation that people realize, like anything, you know, it's 11 men against 11 men. So I was, yeah, it was just great. It was great for everybody. And, you know, there was no jealousy. There was no remorse. It was more pride than anything else.
Yeah, certainly. And you mentioned there Canada. Of course, you made your full debut in 1999 against Northern Ireland. How proud were you to pull on that red shirt?
Yeah, I mean, again, it was quite amazing. You know, I was 23 years old. I had had a later start than most, I would say, in professional career, right? And we had just had a pretty big shakeup in the international side of the game for us. You know, we had a German manager that came in. He was one of the assistants to Beckenbauer. And you know, for me, it was great because it was a new lease on life. I was confident. I was playing. And we did a training camp in the first training camp we did, I think, was in Dusseldorf or in Duisburg. I can't remember. Of course, it was in Germany, right? Get all the players, bring them to Germany. And I had a great camp and I was always comfortable playing around the Canadian lads. You know, I think everybody, we've known each other for so long and I always played well. So I think right away he took a liking to me, which was great. I played like 20 or 25 straight games for Canada. Like it was a great run and we won a lot, right? Which was quite shocking for Canada at international stage. And I think we didn't lose at one point for 20 games or 20 something games. It was quite amazing. But I do remember that first game in Northern Ireland. I think George O'Boyle is from Northern Ireland. So it was just kind of interesting, you know, that whole thing. And, you know, staying in Belfast. And this is still when, you know, there was some issues there. I know there probably still is, you know, some issues. But in terms of, you know, the timing, it was still quite an angry environment. Let's put it that way, right?
Yeah.
And, yeah, it was amazing. It was, you know, probably one of the proudest days of my life. And I think we got a draw. I think we tied 1-1. I think Mark Burcham scored that day. The most un-Canadian ever. We were just taking him from anywhere. And no, Burcham was a fantastic lad and a fantastic player. And anyways, we got a great result there. And then it just went from strength to strength. I think the challenge was at that time I was playing so much for Canada and being chosen so much that I was always having to leave our club situation, which is very, very difficult as a player because it's not like we're flying to, you know, Hungary for a game or to, you know, to Spain. I'm flying to like Tegucigalpa, Honduras, which is, you know, seven planes, 22 hours, you know, get there 2 days before the game, three, and then you're back over to and I'm flying to Inverness or whatever at the time.
But
it was a long shift for the boys and we weren't flying first class. So it was, you know, it was just, it was just what we did, right? But it was crazy if you think about it. It was crazy. You know, we were flying all over the place and playing qualifiers. And anyways, it was great. You know, that time again was, I'd say those 4 or 5 years obviously were like the golden, for me anyways, it was just the most fun I was having, scoring goals and playing and having fun.
Yeah, in terms of the travelling time, it's quite topical at the moment because Scott Arfield, who's of course the Canadian captain just now, there's talk, a lot of Rangers fans feel that he looks fatigued and he needs a rest, but he's going and playing for Canada every other month. Did that sort of affect you? Was a sort of mental and physical fatigue that you felt when you came back from these jaunts?
Oh man, that's a loaded question. I mean, obviously the Canadian team's got some great, you know, we got some great weapons right now and the young team's looking good. And I think you need a guy like Arfield. I don't know him, but I think you need a person like him to really create that balance from a senior leadership perspective. from his perspective, I mean, I think he got his dream move to Rangers. And I think, you know, with them playing in Europe and the league, there's no doubt. There's no doubt that it puts, I don't know if you would say it puts years on you or if it takes years away from you.
Mm.
But, you know, jet lag is jet lag and travel is travel, and travel never goes smoothly. And, you know, the one thing I'd say about these guys now, and I guarantee you that Scott's not flying, you know, coach.
No.
To wherever he's going. So he's flying first class, which is nice. And I'm sure it's a lot more comfortable, but it is a toll on your body. There's no doubt. And it's hard because, you know, you don't want to say no to your country, right? Especially
yeah,
for
definitely.
Him, he's kind of like an adopted son. And, but you know, do you really need to fly to go play the Dominican Republic?
Yeah.
That's the challenge. And I would say for him, you know, he's a mainstay in the team. He is a cornerstone of that team that I think he's going to have the ability to pick and choose a little bit. So, yeah, but I mean, again, I think he's a fantastic player, and, you know, I still watch the Scottish football leagues, and I think he's done an amazing job with Rangers, and I think he'll continue to do so regardless if he plays for Canada, you know, as many matches as he has or not.
Yeah. You guys won the Gold Cup, is that right? And you played in the Confederations Cup. Were they sort of highlights for the Canadian team?
Yeah, I mean, it was funny. That's 20 years ago. Almost 20 years ago next year, right? It was 2000.
Wow, time flies.
Yeah, time flies. Yeah. It's funny, my wife, you know, I know a lot of the guys, they'll keep their medals out and all this kind of stuff. I've got two boys that are 10 and 7. And the other night, they're like, Dad, what's that yellow bin up in the storage room? I said, that's where your mother puts my stuff. So I pull it down, and I pull out about, you know, I think I played for Canada 32 times, 34 times. And I pull out every jersey, right? Every jersey that we ever swapped, a lot of the jerseys that I wore, and all my medals and my winner's medals. And yeah, so it's funny you say that, because we just did that recently. You know, we were getting ready for Halloween and stuff, and I was pulling out all this. And I pulled out the Gold Cup winner's medal in 2000, mm-hmm. the Gold Cup bronze medal in 2002. You know, my Livingston Division One championship pin and trophy and medal. And anyways, it was a really, really cool moment for my boys and for me. And but it was an amazing, amazing run. I mean, we went into there, I think, ranked second to last. I think it was 12 teams. I'm mm-hmm. trying to remember off the top. We were ranked 11, and, you know, we were an afterthought, really. I mean, Holger had come in, so we were invigorated for sure. But we you know, the big story there is that we came out of the round robin tied with South Korea on goals, on points, on every metric. And the only metric that they couldn't do was they flipped the coin. And I remember sitting in the tunnel of it might have been the Rose Bowl. You know, we were sitting in the tunnel of I can't remember where we were playing, and this guy is holding a coin, and there's their coach and our coach, and 22 Canadian guys hanging over watching this coin toss, and we won the coin toss. It was crazy. We went to the next round, and we never looked back. You know, we won every game. You know, it was for us. It was just like, what do we have to lose? You know, let's go out and do the business. Let's go out and do the best we can. As we started to progress, you know, we started to go, hey, we can win this thing. And you started looking at the teams that are left and
yeah.
our attributes. You know, guys that were supposed to score were scoring. Guys that were supposed to save the ball were saving the ball. Craig Forrest had an amazing tournament, and then yeah, we got to the. I think it was we played Dwight and Russell. I think in the semifinals. Against Trinidad and Tobago.
Yep.
And Craig saved a penalty, and we won. I think we won 1-0 or 2-0, and we won that game. And again, we always felt pretty confident against Trinidad. We knew we could do okay and get by them. But I remember us, and I got hurt that game. Unfortunately, I dislocated my shoulder, and we tried to get it fit for the final, but just couldn't. But I remember sitting in the locker room, and someone came in and said, "You guys know that you guys have now qualified for the Confederations Cup," and we're like, "What?" we didn't even think about this. And they're like, yeah, you're playing Colombia in the final. Colombia's, you know, we knew they were South American. I mean, we were just, you just finished a game. You weren't thinking about that. And then we were like, wow, we're going to the Confederations Cup. And that was the year of Japan, South Korea.
Yeah.
So anyways, we went into the final even with a bigger chip on our shoulder with nothing to lose. And probably the best game of the tournament. The boys played really well. And we beat Colombia, I think, 2-0 and won the tournament. And, you know, I think there were 17 people in the stand. Like it was the worst potential final that the U.S. could ever hope for, right? You'd probably Haiti in the final than Canada. And there was – I joke – I kid you not, there were probably 27 people in the final.
Wow.
And, And anyways, we won, and we celebrated like we won the World Cup. It was the greatest thing in the world. And you know, and the sad thing is, it got a little bit of press here in Canada. You know, we were front page of the paper in Vancouver and all over Canada, and then it died. And yeah. I always look back and say, you know, the reason that Canada's never qualified for a World Cup since 86 is, you know, there's just no presence. Nobody knows who we are. Nobody knows any of the players. Nobody has anything understanding of what we're doing or how we're doing it. And so there was a real missed opportunity by the Canadian Soccer Association, which at the time I feel was run pretty poorly. I think one of my goals long-term is to eventually, when I stop doing what I'm doing with my business and the other businesses I have, is really go and maybe try to get on the director's board of Canadian Soccer and really help it grow up as a body. I think they've done a great job. They're getting there, but I think they can do more. So anyways, that was that. We won the tournament, and then they're like, hey, you guys are going to Confederations Cup. The other tournament that we qualified for, which we never ended up going to, was the Copa America.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, so we were supposed to, that summer, I can't remember what it was, we were supposed to go to the Copa America. It was in Colombia. And then we were supposed to, and then we went to Confederations Cup in Japan, South Korea. But that year in Colombia was the big year with the drug bust that happened with,
yes.
You know, I know it from Narcos, right? Because I think everybody watched
it. Yeah, what a program.
So anyways, the Copa America got canceled, and we soon never went to the Copa America. And then we went, yeah, and then we went to the Confederations Cup.
And before we touch on Livingston, David, I mean, you mentioned there the Canadian soccer and what have you. I mean, of course, they're getting the World Cup, some games in 2026. Do you maybe hope that the interest might be sparked because of the tournaments coming to country?
Yeah, I think going back to the Confederation Cup, I think one of the things that was interesting even there, I mean, we played Brazil, we played Cameroon, we played Japan. Like, we played in a huge stage in front of 67,000.
Drew with Brazil as well, didn't you?
And we drew 0-0 with Brazil. I think we had 18 players on the field that game, pretty much behind the ball. But yeah, we, you know what? You can't take that away. We drew Brazil 0-0. The best game I've ever played, and I think that we've ever played as a team, was against Japan, and we lost 3-0 to Japan, which unfortunately that the score doesn't necessarily tell the story, but we played fantastically well. We should have won that game. And then Cameroon, I think we lost 1-0. And but, you know, there was just nothing. There was no media. There was no uptake on it, where it was just such a big highlight for Canadian soccer, and it was just a missed one. So I think coming back here to 2026, yeah, I think the one thing we have is, and I think they finally figured it out at the CSA, is you have to make stars of some of your players so that people resonate. You know, my kids know who Antonio Davies is. You know, they know that he's playing for Bayern Munich. They know that he's, you know, he just got named in like top 10 young players in the world. Like, they now know who the players are. Now, we may never have had an Antonio Davies, but we were playing, but we had some pretty good players back in the day.
Oh, yeah.
Paul was playing at Tottenham, and you know, there was definitely some names that could have been recognizable. So I think if they do a good job there, if we do qualify, and I will say this, one win against the United States does not make a qualification. You know, I think we had a good result there, but you know, it's a long road, and you know, I think one of the challenges always with Canadian soccer is we're just not deep, right? So what happened with us during qualifying is, if somebody got hurt, it's really hard to replace a Jason DeVos or even a Carlo Corzine or Craig Forrest, or me for that example, or a left-sided player. Like, it's not like we have 10 in every position or 50 in every position like most countries. We've got one. So I think that's going to be the challenge for the Canadian team qualifying for the World Cup. I don't know. I don't know if we're just awarded a qualification. I don't know if that's been decided yet. I don't think it has.
Yeah, I'm not too sure, to be honest.
Yeah, I would be shocked if FIFA says, okay, here's three.
I think they are expanding the tournament, but I'm not too sure if you get automatic.
Yeah,
please.
I don't know. I mean, so if they don't have to qualify, that's one thing. If they do have to qualify, it's still not as easy as you think. But yeah, I think there'll be a buzz for sure. I think you know, one thing that I think we do well in Canada is we are very patriotic, and I think people will get behind the team, win or lose. And yeah, I think it's going to create some excitement. What the aftermath of that is, I don't know. You know, I just don't think we have the, you know, a lot of people say that we should have our own league and all this kind of stuff. I just don't know if we have the people or the players to support a league. So I don't know. But no, I think it'll be great. You think about it from my kids' perspective. My son's 10. My younger one is 7. You know, for them to watch that, you know, and hopefully even be a part of it, who knows, right? My son, he can be 17, 18 at that time. Maybe he's on the periphery or something if he wants to be. I mean, I don't push them to play. God, if if I could get them to not play soccer, I would, but they just won't. So I'm stuck with it for now. No, it's going to be exciting, and it's going to be really cool for all the kids to have something to look forward to and have something to look up to.
Yeah, it certainly will. Back to Livingston then. You joined the club in probably a golden period for Livingston at the time, finishing third in the SPL. How good was that squad of players that you were involved in with?
Yeah, it was amazing. I mean, I came to Livingston at the end of the season, so I think we were in first when we came, and then I think there were about 8 or 10 games left. I have a winner's medal, so I must have played enough games. But yeah, I mean, even that team, you looked at that team in the first division, that team could have gone up to the Premier League and done well, as it was.
Yeah.
You know? And then when I came, they signed me, they had signed Barry, they had gone out and got Steve Tosh, who I used to play with at St. Johnson, who, you know, great box-to-box midfielder, insane, but great box-to-box midfielder. Anyways, they just brought in some great players, and then they bought David Fernandez, who became a very, very good friend of mine.
Yeah.
You know, we played together for a couple of years and very successfully, I would think, and I would say. And, you know, they brought in Javier Sanchez-Brato as the goalie. Yeah, we had a great squad. I mean, I remember going home in the summers. You know, finally there was a great summer for me where I could really relax and enjoy. You know, I had signed a long-term deal. You know, the club was super happy to have me. We were going to the Premier League. Things with Canada were going great. Everything was going super well. And then I came back preseason, and it was, you know, strength to strength. We started out really well, and we never really looked back. We beat Hearts in our first game, and it was an amazing time. You know, I will say this: it was an amazing time, but it was also an amazing group of people. You know, it was a great bunch of guys, and we were like the United Nations. You know, the Scottish guys were the anomaly in that club, right? I mean, to be honest, I mean, one of my favorite people of all time is David Bingham. And, you know, we had Biggie and we had Barry and we had Steve, but like they were the minority, right? Which was, you know, not great for Scottish football. You know, you look back in hindsight and say it's probably not the way to strengthen your guys' national team, right? To have all these imports and these foreigners. But man, did we have a great time. We had about 5 or 6 Spanish guys. You know, there was myself, there was Marvin from Trinidad. We had a guy from Togo. We had 2 Frenchmen. It was like the best part about us was when we traveled and we'd go to these restaurants and they do pre-match, and you know, usually you have your chicken and your pasta. And I just remember we had a fantastic guy named Philippe Brinquant who was a fantastic player, right? I think it was right back. And we'd go to these restaurants and he wouldn't eat it, and he'd always ask for a steak, and they'd bring him a steak and they'd overcook the steak every time, and all he would say to them is, no, I want my steak bleu. And he'd like do like like the searing sound and c'est fini, you know, like, but it was so funny. And it was just, we all had such a great time playing together. As much as it was a dog eat dog world in terms of you wanted to play, you wanted to get your appearance fees, you wanted to get the bonuses, you wanted to, you know, get your, you know, expand your career. It was really everybody just, we just had such a great time. And when you're winning, it's easy. Right. And we were winning a lot. So we just had a great time. And I thoroughly enjoyed Livingston. I loved the fans. They were very supportive of me. I lived in the community. We got to Edinburgh a ton. So I was, it was honestly on cloud 9 when I was there.
Yeah. Jim Leishman was there as a manager, quite a colourful character. What was he like to play under?
Yeah, it was an interesting setup, right? It was Jim and it was Davey Hay. So very, very different people. You know, Jim is a rah, rah, rah kind of motivator, and Davey is really a tactician, you know, and Davey was, again, one of the best football minds I've seen. And I loved playing for them both. You know, very different again, but I love playing for them, and everyone loved playing for them. And I think you saw that in the way we played. We would die on the field for each other. You know, whether it was Dave Fernandez, who, you know, obviously was a magician with the ball, he worked his ass off, and everybody did. And I think that was the key. I genuinely think that was the key of our success was, yeah, we had some good players, but every team has good players. I think we had a real camaraderie within the team, and it showed.
Yeah, how much did you enjoy going and playing the Rangers and the Celtics when you were at Livingston?
I loved it. Like, I love, for me, the bigger the game, hopefully this is what people would think of me, the better I was. But, you know, it was tough. I mean, don't get me wrong. You're going to those places and you're not always playing the way we want to play. You know, you're playing maybe one striker up, or, you know, it was often me. So you're kind of alone a little bit. at Celtic Park or at you know, at Ibrox. But no, I mean, if you can't get up for those games and if you don't enjoy those games, you shouldn't be playing the game. So no, I always loved it. You know, the best part, you know they appreciate when they start chanting about you. And I remember, I don't know if I can say this on the air, but yep. They used to sing the song calling me a sheep shagging bastard. anyways, you know when you got a song, you're doing something right. So
that's the one.
But I loved it, and we always had a great time. And I would say probably the most memorable game. And I was thinking about this last night. The most memorable game for me that I ever played in was, I can't remember what season it was, but it was when Celtic and Rangers were tied for points. I think they were even tied or very close on goal difference. And whoever won the last game of the year basically won the title.
Ah, yes.
We were playing at Celtic Park, and, you know, the team that they had at that time with Larsson and I think it was Mravchik and Balde. And I mean, it was a world-class team.
Right? Yeah.
From a European – I mean, they beat Juventus. Like, you know what I mean? Like, or I think they lost or they beat – whatever.
They reached the UEFA Cup final that season, I think, as well.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, they did. And they're, you know, John Hart. They just had such a great team. Anyways, and then across the pitch you've got – or across the river or whatever, you've got – you know, I can't remember who's playing against Rangers and – All I remember is just the crowd. Like, I've never seen a crowd like that in my life. And I know that I was watching Lazio and my sons were watching, and Inzaghi said it's the greatest environment he's ever seen, and he's right. Like, it is a cauldron, and it's amazing. And as a football player, it's the greatest thing. But anyways, I remember that game. We lost 5-1, and that wasn't the highlight. Believe me, the highlight was we were all, you know, as we're disappointed coming off the field. I remember that they were bringing the trophy in, and I think it was in a helicopter. And I think the helicopter was like hovering between the two stadiums or something and I just remember this, they landed, they brought out the awards or I can't remember what's called, you know, to put the trophy on and where all the players stand on. And we were all sitting in the dugout watching it going, wow, I wish I was one of those guys right now. But no, it was just an amazing, you know, it was an amazing time. And it was, for me, it was, you know, great because that year, I don't know if it was that year, but I think we had qualified for Europe, and I had scored 2 goals against Dunfermline to seal the deal and to seal European qualification. And it was, yeah, again, it was just a great year.
Yeah, and you mentioned the European qualification. You played in an epic game against Sturm Graz for Livingston. It was quite a couple of legs that those games in the 4-3 game at Almond Vale, and then you lost 8-6 on aggregate. What was it like to play in those games?
Yeah, so this is another one of those, you know, going back to, you know, you're asking about Scott Arfield, and you know, I didn't get to play in the first game against Sturm Graz because I had been away with Canada, and I was in the squad, but I wasn't in the starting 11, and it was the same for Vaduz that was in the first round. I played I played a little bit the first game, so you know, these are some of the sacrifices, right? And I think some of the people don't realize this sometimes is, you know, choosing to play for your country, you know, you don't want to turn it down. Obviously, I mean, it's the biggest accolade you can ever get, but you're also trying to build a career. And for me, you know, you perform well against Sturm Graz in 2 legs, and all of a sudden, who knows what's next, right? So anyways, we lost it. I was at the stadium in Sturm Graz. I was very disappointed that I didn't play. And I, you know, again, I like Marmite, you know, I don't hide my very well. And we got back to Almond Vale, and really we had no chance. I think we were down 3-0 or something, or 4-1, I can't remember.
Yeah.
And we got back, and Davey and Jim said, okay, you're in, you're going to play. And we pumped them, you know, we won 4-3, but it should have been 7-3. And it really, we almost got there. We could have turned it around, right? It would have been epic. But even the fact that we won a European game on home soil, the fans were happy. We had played well. You know, I did it with my, you know, friends, Barry Wilson and Marv and all these guys. It was a really cool moment for us, for sure.
Yeah, when the time came to leave Livingston, you joined Falkirk, of course. Were you? I think there was a management change, wasn't there, at Livingston? Was it? Did you just feel the time's right to be on the move again?
Yeah, no, it was kind of sad, to be honest, because I thought Jim and Davey had been doing a great job, and they brought in a Brazilian guy, and you know,
yeah, you know, that didn't work out too well.
Yeah, well, I don't know how many Brazilian managers are coaching in Scotland, but you know, it's a, especially at that time, you know, it was just a different mentality. And again, I don't think he didn't appreciate me as a player. It was just, hey, he was bringing in his own guys, and I didn't play under him, which was disappointing. And then I think he left pretty promptly, And I think Davey came back, or I think Davey stayed on. I can't remember. And anyways, I had kind of made the decision with my partner at the time that it was time to come home for a lot of different reasons, not just footballing reasons. And sometimes you make decisions not always about yourself, right? And so I decided that it was time. So, you know, I do feel bad about my time at Falkirk, to be honest, because it was a great club. It was a great, you know, Yogi was a great guy and a great manager. And I should have done better for the club, and I didn't. You know, I don't know if it was I was already one eye, you know, back home or whatever. Probably, you know, pretty disappointing that I didn't score more goals and I didn't do more for the club at the time. And it's sad to see the demise of the club now. You know, I keep an eye on all the old clubs that I've played for, and even all the old players that I played with. You know, I recently read something about Davey Hagan, and I remember Dave.
Yeah, he's not too well at the moment.
No, I played together at Livingston, and you know, I told my son about him last night. We made a donation. You know, I think you have to remember, right? I mean, you have to remember the players and the time. And anyways, so Falkirk was, yeah, it was unfortunately not I'd say the highlight about that is I got to play with Russell Latsby at the time. And,
yeah.
And you know, Russell's just a character. And we had a great little group there. And it was fun. It was a fun time to play there. I just didn't play my best. And you know, in hindsight, I'm kind of regretful of that. But yeah, from there, then we kind of shut it down and decided to come home. And I think I was 29, so it was pretty young. I was still scoring goals. I was still playing well. I had lots of offers to stay. And yeah, just made the decision to come home.
Yeah, funny you should mention Russell. I spoke to two previous players that played with him, and they say he was absolutely outstanding. John Henry and Matt Glennon that played with him at Falkirk, and they say the same. They say they could have. I mean, it was like he was playing with slippers on. He was so good.
Yeah, he was. He was different class as a player and as a lad as well. You know, he's just a wonderful guy. And but it's funny things you remember, right? That would never happen today. I remember there were times when Yogi would be yelling at us, and all of a sudden you'd see smoke coming out of the top of the
the
stall. And you know where Russell was, right? He really was listening, but not having a cig. So, anyways, it was just an interesting time. And again, I wish I could have done more for the club at the time. And but it was great. I mean, I, other than my time at St. Johnson, which was a really hard time for me, and maybe I was just soft, I don't know. But I really enjoyed every moment of being in Scotland. I loved the people. I loved the clubs. I loved the players. And you know, as much as I was a bit of Marmite, and I always, you know, maybe that was maybe a little bit of my my armor a little bit. I really did enjoy playing with every single player I played with, and I appreciated the opportunity to play, because I was a kid from a suburb town in the middle of nowhere in Canada, who was playing in front of 80,000, 60,000 players or people at Celtic Park and Ibrox. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, certainly. You pleased to sort of end your career at Vancouver Whitecaps?
Yeah, I came back and I had kind of set that up when I was leaving Falkirk. And for me, I'd already also committed to go back to university. So my university at the time, they had kind of said, we'll pay for your last semester if you come back and help coach a little bit. So I did. Went back and finished my finance degree. I took, I think, 10 classes in my last semester. Anybody that has gone to uni knows that that's a pretty heavy schedule. So I was actually driving up from Portland, Oregon to Vancouver every weekend, which is about a 6.5-hour drive, going to university, trying to finish my degree, try to fulfill my commitments to the club. And I fell out of love with it pretty quickly. And I played for a season, and it was great, great fun. And then the second season, coach and I just kind of sat down and more him than me, to be honest, kind of said, listen, I don't think this is working. And so that was it. I kind of shut it down and had an opportunity to go back east and play for another team, which is now an MLS team. Probably could have got on the horn and gone back to Scotland. But, you know, I just said, you know what, now's the time to transition. And I think if you ask the guys, you know, you ask Barry and you ask a few of the other guys, they always used to laugh at me on the bus because I'd be reading, you know, finance magazines. Or when I was, you know, I was playing for Livingston, I was going to Napier University. I don't think many people knew that.
Wow.
I took about 6 classes at Napier University when I was there, and economics and organizational behavior, just all this stuff, right? It was what it was. But I would always say this, and I think if you ask anybody, I wasn't your stereotypical footballer. And I liked the game. I was never a lover of the game. And that was probably a bit of a downfall for me in the end. But hey, I loved my career. I loved what I did. And it's just thankful for the time, to be honest.
Yeah, and nowadays, of course, you went into business in 2012. Is that correct? To set up, I was reading here, a mobile bicycle repair business. Is that right?
Yeah. I started. So I worked in an energy company for a while, and decided again that, you know, like Marmite, some people love me, some people didn't, and I decided to go on my own and start my own business with a friend of mine, and it's a franchise business. So in 5 years, we were able to grow the business to, significantly over $10 million in revenue.
Wow.
And we've got 130 franchise locations on the road. We're one of the fastest growing franchise businesses in North America. We recently got awarded with Entrepreneur of the Year. We just raised our first financing of multi-millions of dollars. So, things are going pretty well. You know, I'm enjoying it. I feel like I'm building my second career. You know, it's funny when I sit down and talk to people and they ask me what I used to do, I don't know where to start, especially when you're starting in a business. You know, you're trying to figure out how far do I want to go? How far do I want to tell these guys? But, you know, one thing I will say is, I always wondered, and I think a lot of players wonder, what do you do next? What do you do when you're done? And there is a lot of transferable skills that you acquire playing football that translate into running a business or even being an entrepreneur. You know, I had to be the most thick-skinned guy trying to make it in the UK, because you can imagine what I was called at training and what I, you know, the things that you hear. I think ultimately what's made us successful, you know, and I have multiple businesses and I've run multiple businesses, and I think all the things that I learned in football and from the different managers that I managed under, I've taken things from some and none from others and tried to apply them to my life now. And yeah, I'm enjoying it. You know, people ask me, do you enjoy your life more now or do you enjoy it when you were playing football? And honestly, I can honestly say that for me, it's the same. I love what I'm doing now and building something. I have the two most beautiful sons, very talented boys. Hopefully one day, you know, we'll be talking about them in the Daily Record or who knows. And, you know, my wife's super supportive, and I think things are good, you know, knock on wood. You know, our health is good and we're happy. And hey, you just let me talk about myself for an hour and 6 minutes, so I'm super excited.
Yeah, it's been an absolute pleasure as well, David. Thanks very much for taking your time out and joining us on the podcast this week.
Yeah, no, thanks very much. And, you know, I think last thing I would say is, you know, I think, you know, it's been great to see Scottish football, you know, coming back and getting some of the strength that it had in the past. You know, I look forward to bringing my sons and their teams over to Scotland to get into some tours and that sort of thing. And who knows, maybe my next venture will be buying a football club and turning it into something that it's that it really should be.
Yeah, who knows? Watch this space, I guess, huh?
Watch this space, man. Listen, thanks very much.
Well, that was episode 20 of the Talking Football podcast with David Sousa. Thanks very much for listening. Remember, you can catch any episode you've missed on iTunes, Spotify, SoundCloud, Podbean, and by visiting derekclarksport.co.uk. We're on Twitter as well. Follow us at talking_football, and we're on Facebook also. Hope you can join me again next week for another fantastic guest. Until then, bye for now.